והאימאם השני we're going to start again from Ois Samach. Mamar Sheni, second essay, Ois Samach, that would be number 60. Okay, so let us, we're going to start, we ended in mid-sentence, let's start again from the beginning of the sentence of this passage. The Kuzari king asks, back to Nun Tes, okay? Omar Kuzari. The Kuzari king asks, "Hayesh et slicha bezed dvarim aspikim mekavim oisam lasecha." The sage referred to tuma, saras, and the like, and the Kuzari king is asking him, "Do you have some sort of logical explanation for these very abstract laws of tuma?" Which don't seem to have any moral or ethical message, like what's the, or logical message, what's the idea? So my chaver, a sage answers, we're just reviewing from last week, I've already told you, that really, there's no, our seichel anyways cannot conceive the whole divine logic. It's way, way, way beyond this. We understand that Hashem is saying that this is how it must be. And really, there's no real point. It isn't even necessarily appropriate to be seeking reasons for these things. It's like a 5-year-old kid trying to explain a rocket scientist, a nuclear physicist's considerations and decisions that he made. Right? So a 5-year-old kid might say, well, he chose that because he likes that color better. So, what's the point? Didn't even start it. Yet he says, Avalani Oimer, yet I do say, Acha Bakosha Samachila, after requesting forgiveness, meaning he says, I'm asking Hashem to forgive me for endeavoring to explain these things. Omi bilti she'egzoshu came. I also will offer an explanation after asking forgiveness. And after qualifying in advance that I am not stating that this is the reason. I'm just suggesting a certain understanding. Which again, as we noted, is the approach that the Kadmonim took. We do look to gain insight into the mitzvahs, because it enhances our performance of the mitzvahs, and it enhances our Judaism in general. Yet, it's always with the realization that this is not the full depth of it. Now, it's not that we're saying this might be the reason, but it might not. We're saying, we know that this is not the full depth of it, but yet that doesn't conflict with our answer being correct, because the mitzvahs can contain reasons at very many levels. Right, with Hashem, it doesn't have to be one absolute reason. It's for this reason, everything else is... No, there can be many reasons at very many levels. And we can connect to a level, to a reason that's at a level that we can live on. And on the contrary, we're meant to look to understand these things, because the more feeling we can do the mitzvahs with, the more enhanced it is. But we always have to realize at the same time, this is not the reason. I think we've said in the past that Ibn Janach, he was one of the early Rishonim, he said, he explained why when we talk about mitzvahs, we talk about ta'amei ha-mitzvahs, the ta'am of a mitzvah. We translate ta'am as reason. But ta'am also means taste. Right? Why is this the word used for reason? It's because really, what's the purpose of looking for reasons in the mitzvahs? We're not going to truly understand them anyways. And whatever we do understand is at a very superficial level. But it's like a taste. You eat something because it tastes good. It's not really the food's value. The food's value is nutritional value. It's not necessarily reflected in the taste. Just what? The taste, how does Hashem get you to eat it? You're not eating it because of its nutritional value. You eat it because it has taste. The taste gets you to eat it and enjoy it and makes it palatable to you. It's the same thing with mitzvahs too. You're not necessarily really appreciating the full depth of the mitzvah, but yet, if it enhances your experience of the mitzvah, it gives it a good taste, makes it palatable, that itself is an end, that's an end in and of itself. The more feeling we can do the mitzvahs, and the more we can connect to the mitzvahs on the intellectual level, the better. Not to say that the reasons are not true. Say that the reasons are not the ultimate reasons. They are true. And the mitzvahs were intended to broaden our horizons and understanding of Judaism. But it's still not the ultimate reason. In fact, on the contrary, Maharal says, one of the Kinyanei Torah, right, there are 48 Kinyanei Torah, 48 keys to acquiring Torah. One of them is Oyevis HaMeisharim. He loves the righteousness. Meaning the Maharal says, a person has to learn to appreciate not just the Torah as instructions, but to appreciate the profundity of the Torah. Meaning to learn to appreciate the profundity of a mitzvah. To learn its lessons. Each mitzvah contains lessons. Now again, the lessons that we learn from the mitzvah are based on our understanding of the reason of the mitzvah. So we're encouraged to try to delve into that. Always with that qualification that at the end of the day there's more depth to it. Inevitable. So whatever it is, how do we explain some logic to the dinim of Tum? Tzoras, and also the Tumah of Ziva, which includes seminal emissions, etc., might be associated with Tumas Mes. We understand that a dead human being is a source of Tumah, because it's one of the greatest paradoxes of this world. A human being is the greatest thing in existence. Seeing a dead human being gives a very misleading impression, as though there's an end to human life. It caused Esav to become discouraged and to drop his resolve, right? So that's why seeing a dead human being is a dangerous thing. The impression that there's an end to life is not good. That's why that Hashem makes bodies decompose quickly, so that you should bury them even quicker. Hashem does not want us hanging around dead people. Dead people conveys a problematic impression. Even if you know that he's really living on in the afterlife, seeing a dead person makes an impression on you. You see that there's a certain end to things, right? And therefore, it's tummy.
What happened to Esav?
What's that?
What happened to Esav?
Says that he ridiculed the Bechaira, right? When Yaakov told him, sell me the Bechaira. What was the Bechaira? The Bechaira was a spiritual position. Esav said, why do I need all this for? I'm going to die anyways. Because I'll say, that was the day Avraham Avinu died. Esav came home dejected. The death of Avraham Avinu, such a great man, could die? So what's the purpose of it all? That's the danger of seeing a dead body. Even if our faith is strong, seeing this person, you don't see that he's more alive now than ever. You see that life came to an end. That is a problem. That's why Kayhanim are never allowed to be exposed to that, because they always have to be operating on a higher level of spiritual consciousness. For us, we have the mitzvah of Chesed Shel Emes, of burying the dead, etc. But we're supposed to minimize it. It's a very severe level of tumah, and we are enjoined to get rid of it as quickly as possible, right? Bury them immediately, before it starts decomposing. Not like, right, people who preserve it forever, and they keep it so that they can see it, etc. Okay. So now he says, so if we understand, death is the greatest void. Now a limb afflicted with tzaras is like a dead limb. So it's a miniature death. So it's a miniature tumas meis.
The skin is like dead skin.
Yeah, the skin, the flesh. Va'zera nifsad kein. The same goes for seed. What is seed? Semen. It's potential life. When seed gets wasted, it's dead. So it's also a miniature tumas meis. That's why, by the way, it says that to ruin your seed, to ruin your own seed deliberately, is considered a miniature form of murder. That's why it's expressed in the Torah. If neshaya bal ruach tivi, because this sperm, this semen, actually is something organic. It's something alive. It's got life there. It's got that drop can turn into a man. So when that goes lost, there's a certain element of life that's going lost. Now, so that's as far as the reason why it's tummy. Now, the very concept of tumah, why should these things defile a person? Now, also more than that, there's a paradox that only Jews become tummy. A guy can juggle dead bodies all day long, he doesn't become tummy. Why is that? Shouldn't a guy be more tummy than a Jew? So the answer is no. These things, because of what we just discussed, are spiritual impurities, right? Now, who's going to be affected by it? The one who's going to be affected is the more sensitive person. The more sensitive, the more refined, the more vulnerable it is to problems. Let's say, for example, in a basketball locker room, you don't need things to be sterile, right? But in an operating room where the brain is exposed, things have to be absolutely sterile, because the tiniest germ can cause terrible damage to a brain because of how refined it is, whereas your biceps won't be harmed by it. So that's the idea here. The more refined the person, the more vulnerable to any impurity is. We discussed this concept earlier in Kuzari. And therefore, only Jews are susceptible, are vulnerable to the effect of Tumah, to the spiritual effect of Tumah. So therefore, because this impurity is so subtle, the only ones who will be affected of it it's only those people of very refined spirit, very refined souls, who really are busy connecting to the divine. That once again puts them at a metaphysical level, and therefore things that might not just affect coarse physicality, right? A dead body is not going to be metame a fly. Well, once you're talking about something of a greater spiritual level of refinement, it will. So yes, this is relevant for people who are connecting to Hashem. People who can actually connect to visions, to prophecy. These are people who are operating on a more refined spiritual level. They will be affected by these things. And now he says something interesting, which I don't know how we'll explain this in modern terms. But he says that actually, very refined people would actually feel a certain coarseness after they had, let's say, a seminal emission or a ziva or something like that. They would feel a certain obtuseness or something like that until they had actually washed themselves off. So it actually manifested, the finer the person, the more refined the person, the more it manifests. And sometimes they can actually feel it in a physical way. It was something kind of like, call it PMS, you know, like something like women will sense, they feel something coming on, right? Arthritic people sense problems in the weather. So this is also finer antennas that these people have. Ukvanusa. Now this is something interesting. I don't know if anybody can provide more background on this. I'd be happy to hear. He says that actually it's been empirically shown that tamei people, specific tumas, he's talking specifically about a nida, a woman nida, can actually cause physical damage on a very subtle level to very, very fine things. Kapninim vayenis. He says, for example, a menstruating woman who touches wine causes a certain, ruins it in a very, very subtle way, meaning a connoisseur will be able to taste the difference. A regular guy might not. A connoisseur will be able to taste the difference. Also, when it comes to pearls, they do something to its quality. They affect its quality somehow. The actual touch of a nida has a certain effect. So it's interesting. Rabban says that in earlier times, this was considered a universal concept that you kept away from Anida. And even by non-Jews. Nida had a certain effect that they were more attuned to in earlier times. This is there, so for example, you see, remember back in Parshas Vayetze, Vayishlach, where Laban is chasing Yaakov, and he's searching for his stolen idols. So Rachel took them, she hid them under a pillow, she sat on it, and then when he came into her tent to search, she told him, I'm a Nida, I can't get up for you. So it says that he searched the whole tent. Ramban says, you know, he didn't answer her. He didn't say anything to her. So Ramban says because they were very, very sensitive, they didn't talk to Nidos at that time because that could harm a person somehow in some very subtle sort of way. This was a universal thing, apparently, which Lavan certainly was not very into halacha. It's not a halachic thing. It's not a Torah thing. This was a certain universal given that even just the speech of a Nida can cause harm. So he's saying that this was something that they knew empirically at that time, that a nida, touching, the Mefarshim here say, even just looking at wine could cause it a little bit to lose its quality, or pearls.
I think at some point, a nida would live in a different house, or in a different room.
Right.
Not come near
to keep away from people. Right, yeah. Right.
And people would sit where she sat.
Right.
She sat down on the chair.
People kept away from it. Right.
Right.
Now, v'rubeinu mishtana mikirvas hamesim v'akvoris. And now he says also, even on a very technical level, people feel affected by coming into contact with dead people or graves. Umisbalbeles nafshenu zmanma babayis ashohoya boimes. We get thrown a little bit. We get confused. We get disoriented by hanging out in a house with a dead body. Now here also, I'm not sure if he's talking to something, some more subtle, refined sensitivity they had in those times, or if he's talking at a very simple level that we can relate to also today. A person comes into contact with a dead body, it's disorienting, right? Now, whereas, if you have a very coarse person, who doesn't know Chachmas, he just knows that his job is to carry, schlep this thing to wherever he needs to schlep it to, not a very intelligent guy, it won't bother him. I remember seeing, when my grandfather passed away, he passed away on Shabbos, they had to transport his body from a hospital to the mortuary, the Chevra Kadisha mortuary. They had a guy did it. I just remember noting how, that it's simple, he was a Puerto Rican or something, how just cool and casual he was about it. I got queasy, I get queasy being around a dead body. I remember he was just really technical. Oh, you gotta get him out. They wheeled him out and brought him to where he needs to be. Well, it's very technical and he could have been delivering papers. So, apparently the more sensitive a person is, the more queasy he'll get. I don't know if he's talking about that or if he's actually talking about, again, some more subtle, abstract reality. I don't know. A person of a more coarse nature isn't affected by these things. It's fine. He says, you see this also by the philosophers, this phenomenon. That let's say a philosopher wants to meditate. Now we have to realize that this is also something we don't relate to today, just because today, thinking as an initiated activity is not really a field. Who does that? But in those days, the philosophers worked out thinking and meditating. The truth is today also, you have parts in the world where meditating is a developed science, right? The Far East, the Chveis. Yeah. So they do it in the context of their religion. But the truth is that in and of itself, we don't want to credit them with anything. But in and of itself, meditating is a field that you can develop to different levels. Thinking. Right? Philosophers like to get themselves into a state of meditation just in order to be able to focus intensely for what? For intellectual pursuit. It was a well-developed field. They said in this field, it's known, the phenomenon also, that there are certain things, coarse activities, things that can ruin the effect for a while. I'll give a simple example. a person who doesn't watch movies. Maybe I shouldn't have this on the recording, but from my own experience, I don't watch movies at home. I hope you believe me. I don't have any of the means, but on the plane, you can't help but see secondhand movies, right? I didn't turn on my screen, but all around me there were screens on, and there's things going on. You know, when you see somebody charging with somebody else with a knife, you notice, right? And things like that. Different scenes, you know. There's the scene with the guy in front of me and the guy next. Each one has a screen on their chair, and each one has a different movie on. So, if I see a wolf attacking somebody over here.
The map of where the plane is.
Right, exactly. That's right.
12 hours.
Yeah, it's very exciting. So there's a wolf chasing somebody over there, and there's someone attacking with a knife over there, and there are two people slugging it out right in front of me. You see these things. Now, I don't know if it works, if a person's seeing movies every day, I don't know if it works that way, but for me, these scenes were going through my mind the next 24 hours. Right? I kept on seeing the guy being thrown off a cliff, and I kept on seeing all these different scenes were going through my mind the next 24 hours. So I don't know. I don't know how it works with a person who sees movies all the time. But I don't know if there's such a thing as watching a movie and then forgetting about it. I don't know. But whatever it is, I doubt it. I think that even the people who are used to seeing it, the nicer, they can't have a completely focused state of mind. But the point is that yes, things have an effect. So he says yes, when the philosophers wanted to get themselves into a meditative state, which was a science, knew how to do it. Or when the ascetics of earlier times who wanted to get themselves into a meditative state for the purpose of prayers, whether it was for the purpose of prayer, whether it was for the purpose of intellectual pursuit, right? They find that there are things that disrupt it. You have to be careful about what you engage in for a few days before that. For example, coarse foods, or even just eating too much, or drinking too much, hezek. These things weigh you down, right? There's another experience. Again, in a more broad, in a more coarse way. Gemara after challenge is a challenge. After challenge, gravity pulls you to the bed, right? That's why I know I try to set up my learning on Shabbos before the challenge. After the challenge, puts you to bed. So, apparently, there's also such a phenomenon that eating certain foods kept you back for a while. Not just immediately afterwards you're heavy, but kept you back for a while. And here he gets to the point that we said. Also, we're not talking spirituality now, we're talking philosophers who want to engage on pure meditation and intellectual pursuit. They would find it disruptive if they hung around with women, if they engaged in coarse and base activities. These things hindered their minds from functioning well. Bechevrat halitzani, from hanging around with scoffers. Just hanging around with frivolous in a frivolous setting, in a non-refined, respectable setting. Vis'asik mishirei ha'avo v'aschoik. And being involved in love songs and other such things. So he says these things, you don't have to be Jewish to experience this. He says the philosophers of earlier times who really developed intellectual pursuit into a science found that these things were impediments and therefore they avoided them. So you see that, yes, someone else might come along and say, well, these things don't affect me. So you hear all the time. Yeah. To me, it's not a conflict with spirituality. You're a weaker type. I'm strong enough, these things don't affect me. It's the other way around. It's not that you're strong enough and therefore it doesn't affect you. You're on low enough a level that it doesn't affect you. But yes, hanging around with women, seeing the wrong sights, reading the wrong things, these inhibit intellectuality, they inhibit spirituality, etc. And therefore, yes, it's very important to realize the person thinks he can expose himself to the garbage that's out there and still be able to engage in spirituality. You might feel that he's getting ahead, but you have to realize that it's holding you back very, very much. And if you don't realize it, it's just because you're desensitized. That's what Rabbi Avigdor Miller said. He was once speaking against, I forgot what it was, whether it was the influence of the media or whatever it is. These things, you cannot get ahead of spirituality, they inevitably affect you, etc., etc., etc. A woman came over to me afterwards and she said, these things don't affect me at all. They don't affect me at all. I can still pray properly. Yeah, I can read all these things. I can be exposed to all these. It doesn't affect me at all. So he told her. He said, Marshal. He said, if there's a car accident, two people are hit by a car, and one person is yelling and screaming, the other person is lying still. Who's in worse estate? The guy who's lying still is in worse estate. The guy who doesn't feel any pain is in grave danger. The guy who's yelling and screaming, okay, you can get to him in 2 minutes, right? He'll be fine, ultimately. Might have broken a few bones. The guy who doesn't feel pain is in grave danger. So, said, I hope that the nimshal is self-understood. But when a person doesn't feel, when a person feels the damage, feels, oh, yeah, that book that I read, or that film that I saw, or whatever it is, it held me back, right? It caused me harm. It caused me to slide. Okay, that person is like the guy who broke his leg. Fine. He'll mend. But when you have the person who says it doesn't affect me at all, that person is in a spiritual coma. So in other words, the point that he's getting across, where's he going with all this? Really, all these he's just saying is a mashal for the concept of tumah. Tumah affects the spiritual person. The more spiritual, the more it affects him. Therefore, for example, at the times of Nevuah, today, by us, it's all issues of halacha, technicality. We know that you can't eat truma while you're tameh, this, that, right? But in earlier times, when they were really connected to spirituality, and apparently, in his times also, 1,000 years ago, they were able to connect to these things, a person who wanted to get Nevuah had a harder time if he was tameh from a sheretz. Because these things actually had an effect. If you were in high enough a place, you really felt the effect. So really he's just trying to bring home the point that tumah to us sounds like a chuk, a collection of chukim. But when you understand the concept of more sensitive people, more refined people being sensitive to things that less refined people are not, it could be that the whole concept of tumah is not a chuk at all. It's something that's very obvious to a person who's really on that ultimate level of spirituality as they were in the time of Nevuah, etc. Right? I think it was Rabbi David Kaplan. Somebody was once challenging him. Why do we need mechitzas of jewels? There's always that, it's some ignorant stupidity that it's because we don't like women. It's the contrary, we like women. That's why we have a mechitzas. Right? But he said, why do you have to have mechitzas of jewels? So Rabbi Kaplan said, come on, it's going to distract you from davening. Let's be honest with ourselves. You can't daven, right? You can't have the proper focus on davening without a mechitza. So the guy said, conservative and reformed temples manage just fine. Seriously, is this? Rabbi Kaplan said, I guess they're morally stronger than we are. Right? Meaning, yes, obviously, the more refined you are, the more sensitive you're going to be to these things. Okay. So Amar HaKuzari. Kuzari says, Zemaspikli batoras mashi stapik hanefesh. Okay, you have resolved the question that I was bothered by of Lomahu metame ze hamoisa ha'atzmi. So I was always bothered by this paradox. We mentioned it last week. But it's Lomah HaZera. How come sperm, semen, which is actually a part of you, it's your genes, it's something of very high value in terms of biology, right? That's metame. Even though it's actually, it's even a spiritual thing, it's something alive, it carries life. That causes tumah. Whereas feces and urine are not metame. It always seems paradoxical to me. Tumah is impurity, right? So these things should be even more impure. First of all, there's a lot more of them. And second of all, it's so much more disgusting, and it's really not part of a person, etc. Why should semen be tummy and this not? This is now I understand. On the contrary, it's because of what semen is potentially, that it has that element, like we said before, of Tumas Meis, etc. Whereas these things, they might be disgusting on the physical level, but on the spiritual level, they simply are nothing. They have no value. So they have no significance. It's not Tumas. What I still don't understand is, why, what's the idea of the tumah of the home and the garment? You said the tumah of a person, tsaras of a person, is because that part of the body is dead, etc. But what about tsaras of the home and the garment? What death is there there? A dead garment is not tumah, neither is a dead house. So why should tsaras of a house be tumah? So Omar al-Khomer. So the sage answers. You're right, that's a different concept. It's got nothing to do with Tumas Meis, it's a different concept. Kvar amarti lecha, I've already told you, ki ha-shechina ha-isa b'Yisrael b'madregas ha-ruach b'guf ha-adam. The Shechina in Klal Yisrael is analogous to the neshama in a person. Klal Yisrael is the body and the Shechina is its soul. Okay? Vayila oisam ha-chiyus ha-elikis. And therefore, on the national level, the Shechina was our vitality. That's like what we discussed not so long ago. That's why today, without the Beis HaMikdash, we are likened to a dead body. It's like on the national level. It's a nation without a soul. It's a dead nation. Right? Remember that discussion? Yeah? It's like a dead nation. We don't have a soul. It's a dead Jewish people without the Shechina among us. The presence of the Shekhinah in Klal Yisrael manifested physically. It brought the level of life in Klal Yisrael to a different level. As we discussed, produce was different. Health was different. The all of agriculture was different. Everything was operating on a much higher level of vitality. People were much more supernaturally successful in all areas. Why? Because the Shekhinah was pulsing among them. So therefore, he says, the Tzara'as is also, in a way, like Tumas Meis. Meaning what? When the Shekhinah leaves, departs from the Jewish people, their council is ruined. V'yisbaru gufeihem. Their council is ruined, they lose their seichel. We'll see how this manifests soon, what this means today. Have we lost our seichel? We'll see soon that yes. But, I just saw it, says the Navi, Ein Torah. It says in Yirmiyahu, after the Churban Beis, Beis HaMikdash, there's no Torah in Klal Yisrael. I mean, all the Torah we have, we're talking about immense Torah, the Torah, the Chazon Ish, the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Akiva, Rashi, right? From the perspective of the Beis HaMikdash, the person who lives in the Beis HaMikdash, Rishon ain't Torah. There's no more Torah in Klal Yisrael. Meaning there was an immense, even just intellectual drop in our capacity to contain Torah. All the Torah that we know is ain't Torah in comparison to what the level of Torah scholarship in those times. And also physically, look, since the Shekhinah left the Jewish people, they're physically pathetic, right? Look, we've been suffering, being schlepped from nation to nation, bouncing around, weak, etc. And the glory of the Jewish people is gone. So that's how it works on the national level. What we're seeing today is the dead Jewish people on the national level. In those days, how does it work? If the Shekhinah left a person, it manifested in a more localized way. How'd that manifest? When the Shekhinah distances itself from one individual, meaning it's among Klal Yisrael. And therefore, all of Klal Yisrael is operating in the highest and high gear. But if it distances itself from one individual, nira al admas ha'ishahu, that would manifest on that in a physical way in that person's land. Simin hisrachik or hashchina mimenu, you would see that the light of the Shekhinah distanced itself from him. How did that you see that? You saw it in the tzaras. Just like we said that tzaras on a person's body is a manifestation of a certain lack of vitality, right? It's like that part of the body died. Meaning that an individual limb can lose its vitality even when the rest of the body is doing fine, right? That's what tzaras on a home or on a garment is. The Shekhinah departs from this person individually, and the distance of the Shekhinah manifests in a physical way. You see his house looking weird. You see his garments looking unhealthy. It's all the same thing. It's again the concept of Tumas Meis. Just on the more national level, on the broader level of the Shekhinah as the soul of the Jewish people departing from this person, and therefore you saw it manifest not necessarily on his body even, but on his property, because the Shekhinah is not there. And therefore, this is a dead piece of property.
You say that about a house that burned down?
What's that?
A house that burned down.
No. Why wouldn't we say that? I'll give a mashal. If you see a cut, a deep gash on a person's arm, that does not indicate an inner disease, which means that the arm has lost its vitality. It means that something happened, it's external. Whereas certain types of diseases, let's say gangrene, how do you pronounce it? Is a sign that something died inside the limb. It's detached from its source of life. You can see a mutilated hand, chas v'shalom, from a terrible event, but it hasn't lost its connection to the whole nervous system and everything. It's still 100% vital, just it's wounded, right? Whereas a hand afflicted by gangrene or other such of these types of things are paralysis of certain types, are atrophy. These are things that it's actually lost its vitality. It lost its connection to the brain. It's dead. So that's the difference. A house burns down. Fine. That might be an event that happened. Tzaras is a sign of the death of that entity. The Shekhinah left it, which means that it lost its soul, it lost its vitality. Just with these things, it can be Tchiyas HaMeisim, it can be restored. He says also you can see this sort of thing also by people, where it's not full-fledged death, it can even be a temporary sort of death. When a person suddenly, let's say, gets a sudden fright, the blood drains from his face, and he suddenly has become so weak. What happened? So he's saying it's kind of like a miniature loss of life, right? He lost his vitality to an extent. He lost all his color. He can't move, right? And you see, it actually changes the look of the body. V'nir banashim ubanaori bavur chalishus rucham. You can see, sometimes, also, by weaker people, women, or kids, they go out at night by themselves, they're nervous, they're scared, they're stressed out, they come back looking green. So you see that there's this concept of, yeah, a person loses, to an extent, a little bit of his vitality, but he can come back. These are manifestations of losing that spirit, right? Then yachtin zeh l'shev. He says, you know, people tend to attribute this to demons in those times. But it's actually a natural thing. And yes, these sorts of things, even just seeing dead people, can actually cause physiological effects. So basically what he's saying is that there definitely is a concept of, in a general way, seeing things, experiences that affect you physiologically and physically. And sometimes it will vary from person to person because more sensitive people will be more vulnerable. That's the general concept of Tumah. That's the general concept of Tumah. Yes, here we're talking about even a higher level of sensitivity that will be affected by even subtler levels of spiritual impurity. Fine. But these are real things, he says. These are things that are in the physical world. Just, we might not be refined enough to sense them. Just like there are things that we're not smelling, but a dog does smell. They're right here, they're with us, but we're not affected by it. And now B, he's saying that this can even extend not just to a person's body, but going back to the concept of the Shekhinah being the soul among Klal Yisrael, the Shekhinah departing will actually have physical manifestations in a person's property. And just like you see that when the Shekhinah departed from Klal Yisrael, it resulted in losing their strength. They became a pathetic nation, an exiled nation, the underdog. And other declines that we're going to spend more time on, so too on the individual level. And the Shekhinah was among Klal Yisrael. If it departed from one individual for whatever reason, that actually manifested physically in his estate, his home, his garments, or in other areas where it could pop up. Okay. So we'll see the Kuzari King's next question. We'll see how much we'll go further on this. But now we're kind of getting into another field. So actually, let's just sum up. Really, let's chop the subtlety of what the sage is saying here, because that's leading up to our next piece. I said this, I want to bring it out more strongly. He is not relegating the concept of Tumah to the spiritual realm. Or you might say, he doesn't view the spiritual and the physical as two separate planes. He is saying the concept of Tumah is simply a natural phenomenon. It's another manifestation of a natural phenomenon which we're all familiar with, that more sensitive people will be affected by things that other people won't sense at all. And therefore he's saying Tumah is the same thing. Physically, it has an effect. Just that, you have to be at a certain level of sensitivity in order to even be able to feel it. And we might all be far removed from that level of sensitivity, because it might, you have to be on a level of nevoya, I have to be on a level of purity, etc., etc., etc. But he's actually saying that the Torah is not telling us esoteric things, abstract things. The Torah is telling you what you might call laws of nature. Just that they're laws of nature that are too subtle to be detected by our experiences or even by the tools available to science. That's what he's saying. But it's actually laws of nature. So in a sense, what he's saying is, you know what the laws of Tumah is, and this is important for the continuation, you know what the laws of Tumah are? It's advanced science. It's simply science that modern science has not yet detected. They might get there. We see that they're making bounds, you know, they're getting further and further ahead in detecting things that are not, you can't sense with the five senses. They might get there one day, they might actually be able to detect that, yes, like we saw in earlier times, they knew that a needle looking at something could have a certain effect. That they might yet come that they'll be able to detect that, that they'll be able to sense that through scientific senses. Now this is important for the continuation here, because he wants to put this into the realm of worldly knowledge. Just, it's beyond even the greatest of scientists, at least as of today, and therefore it had to be divinely imparted. So therefore, the king responds, and he says, and this is really the preface for the continuation of the discussion, we'll just see this. So the Khuzari says, he appreciates this point, and he accepts. If so, he says, I see that the Torah is based on the most subtle areas of knowledge and science. It's not just, in other words, you're telling me that this is not just about spiritual laws. You're telling me that this is really about understanding the finest elements of nature. So that means that, yeah, the Torah is based on really contained in the Torah are the finest secrets of science. You don't see this with other religions. Other religions, they don't claim to be based on science or scientific knowledge, etc., or laws of nature. There are rites. It's a spiritual realm. The spiritual and the physical have no connection, and that's that. But I see that the Torah actually contains secrets of nature. So Amar Achav. So he says, you're right. And the truth is that for a person to be the ultimate Torah scholar, he has to be the ultimate scholar in everything material as well. Samach Dalet, 64. Sanhedrin hoyu mitzuvim shalai te'olei nehem chokma me'achokma sa'amitiyas. He says the Sanhedrin, in fact, were commanded that they have to be well versed in all areas of knowledge, all fields of knowledge. Hamitius, meaning the absolute areas of knowledge, science, and things that are black and white. Science, math, physics, they had to be at the cutting edge. Vadimionius, Dimionius literally means imaginative, which can mean one of two things. Either it means theory, this is very interesting. Today, science doesn't differentiate between proven fact and theory. It's all in the general heading of science, and they teach it all as fact. Right? There can be a lot of things that are actually theories, but it's all under the general heading of science. In earlier times, they had two clear categories. There were things you could prove in a laboratory, that was one area, and then there was a whole separate field that was called theory. Right? Very important to note this distinction, because it solves a lot of problems when we're approaching the areas of where Torah, so to speak, conflicts with science. Torah does not conflict with science. Torah conflicts with the scientific community, because the scientific community claim that all of their theories are science. So that's where the Torah conflicts. Basically, note that any area where you find the Torah conflicting is issues of theory. I mean that even with regard to things that seem clear-cut, like the dating system. Even the dating system is based on premises which make sense, they're logical, but they're assumptions. Logical assumptions, but assumptions nevertheless. They won't tell you that, right? So whatever it is, but that's parenthetically. They have to be well versed in all the absolute knowledges and all of the imaginative knowledges. That's Kemius. And also in areas of knowledge that are not absolute, but rather are due to agreement. For example, languages. Languages are not sciences, right? These are not absolute laws of nature, but it's another area of knowledge people have to be well versed in. Okay, we'll elaborate on this more next week.